He never guessed very far off the mark. That is, he wouldn't guess 42 as an answer to the question, what is 3 plus 5, but he might guess 6. Monsieur N seemed to have lost the ability to think of numbers as specific entities and handle mathematical procedures such as addition or subtraction. But he retained a rough sense of where numbers fell on a number line and knew that, for example, 9 was a lot of children for one woman, but not enough for a school. The case of Monsieur N suggests that generating a mental number line may be a distinct ability and perhaps a more basic one in terms of our evolution than the ability to do actual math. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by William Oram, with help from Jordan Grafman at the National Institute of Mental Health. There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. I'm Don Glass.
In sports, the Associated Press has learned that the FBI has opened a preliminary investigation into whether baseball all-star Miguel Tejada lied to federal authorities when he denied taking steroids or other performance-enhancing drugs. The inquiry is in response to a congressional request. It amounts to an initial look at facts surrounding the case. It does not mean charges will be brought against the Houston Astros shortstop, who was the American League's MVP in 2002. Major League Baseball team owners voted unanimously today to give Commissioner Bud Selig a 3-year contract extension. It's good through the 2012 season. The Illini women are in Columbus for a game tonight against the Buckeyes. Last night in Champaign, the Illini men snapped a 5-game losing streak, beating Michigan 75-57. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the East Central Illinois Building and Construction Trade Council, union contractors working with organized labor. Together, everyone achieves more. Information on the web at teamclmc.org.
It's 2:42. The number of naturalized citizens in the suburbs ringing Chicago is growing and growing fast, but some still face barriers when they try to vote. In a lawsuit last fall, the U.S. Department of Justice charged that Kane County had violated parts of the Federal Voting Rights Act. County officials quickly agreed to remedy the situation, and the first big test of whether Kane County is living up to the agreement comes on February 5th. That's when the Latino vote might make the difference in several hotly contested primaries. Illinois Public Radio's Chip Mitts.
Republican poll watcher Bob Spurlazo lives in Kersville, a hotspot in the nation's debate over undocumented immigrants. Spurlazo says one reason he became a poll watcher was to help make sure no illegal aliens are voting in Kane County elections. He saw that with his own eyes, he says, in municipal balloting last April.
When those people came in to vote, I was sitting there with my book in my hand that said this person lived in this house that was empty, or this person basically was not registered to vote, but here they are. We are, the citizens are basically having their process of government undermined by citizens of foreign countries coming in and changing the election results.
Kane County officials say they have no hard evidence undocumented immigrants have committed voter fraud. And Elva Mejia is ticked off about this kind of scrutiny of Latinos at the polls. This week, Mejia helped the county launch early voting for the February 5th primaries. She's at St. Monica's, the biggest church in Carpentersville, one of several balloting sites.
She'll help you. Now, it already went through. Now he has to accept it again.
And cast ballot again.
And then that he's done. Now he has to.
Mejia is helping a 36-year-old from El Salvador who's struggling with an electronic voting machine.
If I wasn't here, we would lose a vote, and their vote won't count. And we're stressing as the Hispanic community that your vote will count.
Mejia became an election judge after eye-opening experiences as a 2006 poll watcher for an immigrant rights group. Several precincts in heavily Latino areas opened hours late. Many lacked bilingual judges, and Mejia says one judge scolded a voter for bringing his daughter to the booth to help interpret.
How can so many precincts have a problem? If it's not racial, why did Carpentersville have this many problems?
At the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, Ricardo Mesa was asking himself the same question. Before last April's election, he alerted the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice.
Just because an individual doesn't speak English very well, or maybe not at all, does not mean that that person is not a U.S. citizen, does not mean that that person is not properly registered. It is the job of the clerk's office to make certain that those attitudes and those stereotypes are not in place when folks come in to vote.
What happened next caught Kane County Clerk John Cunningham off guard.
Because I felt very well there's been substantial compliance in Kane County, because even before I came here, they had already translated all of the election documents, even our insert into the papers, from English to Spanish to accommodate that particular law.
That's the Federal Voting Rights Act.
And so the Attorney General's office sent two people into our office to sit down and to ask us if it'd be all right if they would monitor that election up there. And so they were up there, and the election was over, and I called their office, and they said, talk to your lawyer. So at that time, I knew there was an issue.
The Department of Justice filed its suit in September. This kind of enforcement is on the rise. Since 2002, the feds have brought 26 lawsuits nationwide to protect Spanish-speaking voters. Kane County didn't admit liability, but quickly signed a 14-page agreement. It promised to provide 71 bilingual election judges. But with the election just 3 weeks away, the county has signed up just 54.
Why don't you all just kind of crowd around this board that I've got up here for a moment? I want to go over this dual election thing one more time.
And many of the judges still have to go through this three-hour session with part-time county elections trainer George Tim. And that's not all. To make the voting process more accessible, the Department of Justice also forced Kane County to appoint a Spanish-language election coordinator and a Hispanic advisory committee.
It hasn't made a difference.
Linda Ramirez-Lewinsky of Carpentersville serves on that committee.
They don't want the Latinos coming out to vote. The last meeting was actually canceled. They're still short Hispanic election judges or bilingual election judges. As far as I know, they have no translators. Jack is just going through the motions.
Jack is the nickname of Cunningham, the Kane County clerk. For his part, Cunningham says his office will post bilingual election judges wherever they're needed February 5th. He says everyone who's eligible to vote will get to cast a ballot. I'm Chip Mitchell.
There's a building in downtown Chicago full of artists and studios. The Fine Arts Building has housed painters, violin makers, and dancers since the late 1800s. It's also home to another less common art. Illinois Public Radio's Lynette Kalsness reports.
The music of the Chicago Youth Symphony Orchestra resounds through a long, narrow hall. Several floors down, little girls in purple tutus show off ballet steps. But there's another sound that's less musical. It's the clank and clatter of old-fashioned elevators still run by hand. There are no bells or lights that tell what floor people are waiting on. Instead, the operators peer through the glass doors at each floor as it flashes by, looking for passengers. At the Fine Arts Building, there's an elevator operator who's a living part of history. Tommy Durkin arrived from Ireland in 1949, got a job at the Fine Arts Building months later, and has been there ever since.
I don't like to move. I'll stay in the same place. It's much easier. You get to know the people. I know there are people who change jobs all the time. They change apartments, homes. I could never do that, see.
He hasn't changed jobs, but he says the world has changed around him.
People are very busy today. They leave the studio with their cell phone. They're already dialing. They stand before they get on the car. They can't wait for that minute. It's insane.
But he says it's still a warm, wonderful building. Lee Newcomer is the owner of Performer's Music Store.
Not only does he pretty much know everybody's floor, but he's responsible for kind of the tone of the building.
He knows their stories. He can tell their stories sometimes better than they can, because he likes to get to the point quicker.
Kyle Walsh is the property manager. Durkin is known for taking the building security very seriously, while also being master of the 30-second conversation. He's a man of few words, unless the topic's Notre Dame. Down in the basement, in the room next to the boiler, Durkin has a secret clubhouse. It's the Notre Dame Room.
Those are all their national championships here. pictures of them over there. Newt Rockne, you know of him? Yeah.
There's a bar in the corner and a picture of Notre Dame's Basilica.
So the church is beautiful. It is so nice in there that even an atheist would like to stay in there, you know.
He still throws an annual party here for Notre Dame fans. The age of the elevator operator pretty much ended when automation arrived. In its heyday, Chicago had almost 5,500 of them, enough to form a union. Kenneth Cliff is with the Service Employees International Union, Local 1.
We could see the handwriting on the wall, and within 2 or 3 years, we lost about 2,000 members to automation, and the rest is history.
There are only a handful of people left in Chicago who run passenger elevators. Five of them are here at the Fine Arts Building. Architect Jim Harriman says he worries a future owner might modernize the elevators.
You know, it's kind of the heart of the building to have someone carry you up and down. And so you can't just kind of quietly ride to work like you would in a modern high-rise. You kind of get engaged.
Operating an elevator by hand is a dying art that requires a good memory, steady hands, and a gift for polite conversation. And it's no less important to many tenants in the building than the music and art that fills the halls. I'm Lynette Kalsness.
It's 2:51. You might be hearing about geothermal energy more and more. Exactly what is it? The new Federal Energy Act calls for more research and investment into the alternative energy source. Robbie Harris has more on this long-used but little-known technology for tapping the Earth's heat.
Now In Iceland, where geysers gush from the ground and steam rises from the bays, geothermal is the number one source of energy. This island nation in the North Atlantic burns virtually no fossil fuel to heat or cool its buildings.
You will probably not see a single building that's not heated by geothermal energy.
Palt Valdemarsson is director of research and development with Enix. It's Iceland's largest geothermal consulting firm.
And I have never lived in a house in Iceland which is not heated by geothermal energy, not in my whole life. And I am not the youngest one, as you can see.
Valdemarsson says Iceland has used a special technology to tap Earth-generated heat since the 1930s. And why not? It's everywhere on this volcanic island. The first settlers here in the 8th century saw what they called smoke rising from the hot springs.
So this is an average well.
Today, steam blasts from hot water wells at Iceland's newest state-of-the-art geothermal plant. The steam spins turbines to make electricity. The superheated water is piped directly into buildings where it gives up its heat. This heat exchange is the core concept behind geothermal technology. Hans Benemigel is a spokesman for the power plant. He says the benefits for Iceland are simple.
Clean energy and dirt cheap.
Few places have the hot water resources Iceland has, but according to the Geothermal Resource Council, superheated water is available virtually anywhere in the world, if you drill deep enough. The U.S. already taps this underground hot water to produce more geothermal electricity than Iceland does, and that's expected to grow sharply. But for decades, Americans have also used a different form of geothermal energy to heat and cool buildings. Eric Larson is a vice president of Indy Energy. He calls it the other geothermal, which is basically
free heat from the earth in the wintertime in an extremely efficient way to reject heat from the building in the summertime.
Larson says geothermal or geoexchange systems are comparable to traditional heating, ventilation, and cooling systems, but they use the Earth's constant underground temperature, around 55 degrees in most of the U.S., to take the edge off a building's heating and cooling load.
Geothermal heat pump technology, like we're talking about, can be done anywhere in the country. Anywhere where there's ground to drill, we can put in our series of closed-loop wells and exchange heat with the Earth to provide an HVAC system.
For a long time, in rural areas, large horizontal loops, several feet underground, captured and released heat. But in urban areas, there wasn't enough land. Now, Larson says, Indy Energy uses a new drilling technique known as a vertical closed-loop system. He says they can be installed under almost any building. Pipes inside wells hold a fluid, which continuously circulates between the ground and the building, creating a heat exchange. Larson says a geothermal system saves owners money.
We are a system that you would fully own from sort of the generation or the ground loops, these wells that we put in, through the distribution, which is basically happening within your building. So it adds value to your property, and you take advantage of all the savings.
Larson says geothermal systems for buildings cost anywhere from 50 to 100% more than a typical system. But he says most pay for themselves in 5 to 8 years with the energy savings. Business is booming. Larson says Indy Energy plans to expand in 2 new locations this year. 4 months ago, they installed a large geothermal system at Buku Community Center in Evanston, Illinois. During the installation, they helped train new workers in geothermal technology. It was a joint project between Indy Energy and Buku. They're training workers for a new green industry they hope will not only save resources, but create new jobs. For the Environment Report, I'm Robbie Harris.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about the Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
Earth and sky.
This is Jorge Salazar. NASA scientists have taken close-up images from space of what they're calling spiders on the planet Mars. These spiders aren't life forms, but spidery-looking channels carved in ice at the South Pole of Mars. That's according to Candace Hansen of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who used images taken from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to understand how these Martian spiders came to be.
This is a very interesting process because there's nothing like it on planet Earth. What you have is, over the winter, a layer of translucent ice forms. It's carbon dioxide, so on Earth we would call that dry ice.
That's the same dry ice you sometimes see at Halloween.
In the spring, sunlight penetrates through the translucent ice and it warms the surface below the ice. So it's maybe a half a meter of CO2 ice that the sun has to go through. It warms the surface below, and then, as people familiar with dry ice on Halloween know, that ice will turn to a gas when it gets warm.
Hansen said that the gas below the layer of Martian ice is under pressure, so the gas looks for a weak spot to escape, such as a vent or a crack. As the gas shoots out, it carries along dust from the surface with it, which carves channels in the Martian surface as it gets blown up and out onto the top of the translucent ice. We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe and Bevere Cafe 2 on the U of I campus. Bevere Cafe 2 offers gourmet sandwiches, salads, and coffee with seating inside or outside in the lower courtyard of the Institute for Genomics Biology next to Morrow Plots, just off the quad on the U of I campus.
You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director. A strong cold front is swinging through east central and southeastern Illinois this afternoon, resulting in a steady drop in temperatures, currently 28 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the U of I. Readings are expected to fall below freezing, and they have already done that here in Champaign-Urbana, and that's going to lead to icy conditions on roads and sidewalks. Motorists are advised to drive with caution as scattered slick spots will develop, particularly on less traveled secondary roads. Let's take a look at the forecast for Illinois and Indiana. It is topped by a wind chill advisory for northeastern Illinois, including Chicago, that goes into effect from midnight tonight through tomorrow. The forecast tonight, mostly cloudy with occasional flurries or snow showers, especially before midnight, lows ranging from 10 north to 25 in the south. Tomorrow, north and central, partly sunny early, then increasing cloudiness with light snow and flurries possible late in the day. In the south tomorrow, partly sunny, highs ranging from 23 north to 42 in the south. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, we're looking for a low of 18. Tomorrow, the high 27. Friday night, tomorrow night, the low 5, and the outlook For Saturday, partly sunny, windy, and bitterly cold, the high around 10. Wind chill Saturday of minus 10 to minus 20 degrees. Coming up next, it's the world. So stay with us here on AM 580 or online at will.illinois.edu. It's 3 o'clock.